Chef John Fulce welcoming you to Stirring It Up, the best tasting show on radio. From the swamps and bayous of South Louisiana, thanks for joining us in our little piece of culinary heaven where good cooking is just a way of life. Mornings begin here with a roux simmering in a cast iron pot, and our evenings end with thoughts of what we're going to cook tomorrow. All right, everybody, welcome to Stirring It Up, the best tasting show, the best cultural show on radio. We're so happy to have you with us at the kitchen table today. Wonderful that you chose us instead of all that other good stuff you could be doing today. And I want to begin by welcoming Michelle Yark, our executive producer. How are you doing?
I'm doing very well. Thank you for asking. And you?
I'm doing really, really
good. That was
good.
Nice that I asked.
Okay,
that
nice. And across the glass wall, Dean Slime, our engineer, keeping us well balanced in sound, and of course our music dynamic. I love the music you're picking out lately. Let me go ahead and congratulate you. You know, I give so many accolades and congratulate and thank people so much, sometimes it goes unnoticed, huh, Michelle? What?
Is he talking to me?
I'm talking to you, huh? So, you know, so don't take it lightly.
Definitely don't take it lightly.
So, no, good. Thank you for that good music that we got that coming up.
Well, you're welcome, Chef, and thanks for this delicious coffee.
Well, isn't this wonderful, huh?
This is really good stuff.
I like this coffee. Anyway, Michelle, how's your day going so far?
Well, you know, I need a little snack.
You need a little snack, yeah?
I need a little snack. I think I need a sandwich.
A sandwich is not a snack. A sandwich is a meal.
Well, it is if you hold the lettuce and the cold cuts and the cheese.
Yeah, but I think your idea of a pettifor is a po' boy.
A po' boy would be a hot French po' boy, fresh out of the oven, just the bread. That's what I'm kind of having on me. Yeah, okay. Yeah, I can do that.
That's one of the most dangerous things in the world at this place is David Harris pulling
a dangerous man pulling
a whole rack of bread out of the oven, and it smells all over the building, and you just got to get up and go back there, and it's 20 pounds a week, whether you like it or not.
That's terrifying.
It's crazy. Anyway, talking about fresh bread and oven, you speak in my language. You know, I'm a fan of almost anything dough-based in our Louisiana French bread, Slama. Something can't be beat. People try all over the nation to do it, even those guys out in California.
You know,
those famous bread makers out in San Francisco, they try them. Nah, I can't.
That was one of the things, speaking of David Harris, that when he came, he had to perfect Louisiana French bread.
He had to figure it out.
He had to figure it out.
They always said it was the water. So, I mean, he wanted to find out what was it about the water that made Louisiana French bread, like Leidenheim and these guys. Yeah, because David was a guy from Pennsylvania, he had heard about and tasted the French bread, but never quite did it. So he came in.
He perfected it, by the way.
No, he did perfect it, yeah. And if you think about it, dough in some form is present in so much of what we eat. It's been around since Neolithic times. And I always think about who knew? I mean, Neolithic people didn't keep records on dough, I don't think. I would even tell his secretary. How would Neolithic man say, hey, over here, please, a pen, pencil? I mean, really, how would we know they kept dough?
Quick, get me a stone tablet. I need to jot something down.
Well, let me just say this. We know because in every society, almost, there's a dough-based food that defines the culture. I mean, think about it. The Passover. The matzah. Think about the Irish soda bread. Mm-hmm. Think about the Italian pizza, the calzones.
What about fry breads?
The fry breads, the Indian fry breads.
Beignets.
The beignets. I mean, absolutely, no doubt about it.
Sopapillas. Well, you know, the word dough actually has Indo-European roots. Dough means to form or to knead.
Knead as in K-N-E-D.
Yeah, need the dough.
Okay, I got you.
Of course, I do. You know, pulverized grain, wheat, rye, oats, mixed with water to form a paste is the base of almost all dough. But it's the ingredients that you add to the dough, the way you shape it, that determines the end result. And I've heard that kneading dough can actually be therapeutic, kind of like Ann Kearney breaking down a cow carcass is therapeutic for her. Kneading dough can be therapeutic. And I would venture to say everybody has some memory of their mother or their grandmother working over a piece of dough, making cookies, making bread, for me, my grandmother was always elbow deep, covered with flour, making cucharada for Christmas or the little sugar cookies.
The little sugar cookies. Mm-hmm. My mazarang would make these big old roll-out things of dos lama, and she'd lay it flat about, it must have been about a half inch. Then she'd cut these big long strips out of it and put two little slits of the knife in and throw it in the frying pan.
Oh, my grandmother did that.
Oh,
fried bread.
Fried bread with cane syrup and powdered sugar. Oh, my God. She could bring eight Falls Boys to a stop. With that, I mean,
and
no matter what we
coffee.
Were doing,
all eight, huh?
All eight of us. Look, she'd put us a stop. She could stop us in our tracks.
You see, he was uptown because he had powdered sugar and syrup.
The night.
Well, we were.
I ate mine just plain, dipped in coffee.
Well,
we have that for lunch?
We were in the sugar industry. sugar was a commodity around the house. You know what I mean? Well, imagine Slama, a Chinese grandmother would probably be thinking dumplings today. A German grandmother, as Michelle mentioned her grandmother with the cucharadas, a German would be doing little egg noodles or delicious stollen with the dough. David makes great stollens in his kitchen. But, you know, at the end of the day, the dough that started it all, the mother dough, as it's sometimes called, is David's favorite, and that is the one he works on the most, sourdough. It's the oldest form of leavened bread and can be traced naturally the Egyptians.
You know, all I can say is it's a good thing that the Egyptians believed in the afterlife. You know, of course,
yes,
their beliefs are a lot different than ours, but they sure did preserve a lot of stuff in those tomb walls.
Well, that's exactly right.
A lot of food.
Absolutely. That's why we know what they ate, because so much food was in there. And absolutely, the oldest form of leavened bread, as I say, can be traced to them about 1500 B.C. Egyptians also, as I say, made beer, and breweries and bakeries all housed together. And it's likely that the discovery of the effect of yeast and, you know, in the combination of water and flour, could have been the result of some type of just cross-contamination causing that dough to rise, and all of a sudden somebody said, do we throw it away or do we cook it?
That would have been Neolithic man conversation.
Neolithic man was sitting around thinking and said, before I get that stone tablet, let me see, shall I cook this thing or throw it away? And they looked at each other and said, why don't we try it? Throw it in the fire. What the heck? We do that at camps. I mean, that's what Cajun men do. Are you going to eat that or are we going to cook it?
And that's how rabbit sauce pecan was born. Oh, goodness. Well, you know, they also discovered, in all seriousness, that if they saved a little of the original dough and added it to the next batch, it would produce the same flavor. So the saved dough they called starter, or, you know, old dough. But here's an interesting fact. There's a place in San Francisco, Boudin Bakery. It said that they have been using the same starter dough for over 150 years.
Wow.
To achieve the flavor and consistency of their sourdough. Now, John, we're leaving for San Francisco tomorrow. I think we need to pay Boudin Bakery a visit.
No, I've been there quite often.
As
you turn that corner right there at the wharf, as you turn the corner right there, I think it's
you'll know exactly
Pier 35,
where to go.
Pier 35 or whatever they call it. I forget exactly, but there it is right there on the corner, right next to the Dungeness Crab Place.
Oh, I love that place.
Slama, you know, Michelle said just now that the saved dough was sometimes called the start or the old dough.
The old dough.
That brought back memories. Daddy used to say that the family who lived back the track had old dough. I said, Dad, it don't work. He said, they got old dough. I wonder if it's the same. I wonder if it's the same thing. I'm just figuring out now what he's talking about. Maybe he was, I thought it had something to do with
mine. I think he was talking about something.
Well, y'all, today we're really talking about science here, you know, the chemical reaction of the yeast and the enzyme breakdowns that change the consistency of dough. Hydration is also, you know, it has a huge effect. That's where water or liquid is added to this dry flour that creates this medium. A relatively new bread to the U.S. market is one of my favorite, and certainly one that drives us crazy here at our bakery in Gonzales. I'm talking about the ciabatta, bread. It originated in Italy, but was brought to America in 1987 by the Orlando Bakery in Cleveland. Absolutely. I thought it had been here when the Italians arrived from Sicily in New Orleans.
87?
Ciabatta, that's right. Orlando Bakery in Cleveland brought it over. They brought three bakers from Italy to develop the bread and put it into mass production here in the country. Ciabatta's crusty outside and that chewy, crumb texture inside with those large holes that's made in the bread has been just a huge hit with the artisan bread lovers in this country. And the holes are achieved by hydrating the dough. And I was supposed to say that liquid being added to it. Artisan breads generally have at least 60% hydration level. Ciabatta, 85%. Gosh. So that's what creates that. And of course, the sourdough starter is what really makes it puff. You know, it blows those holes into it.
I love
ciabatta. I love ciabatta, and I love hot ciabatta out of the oven. Oh, and we're lucky enough, or I should say unlucky enough, to have it every day here.
I hope David's making some today.
Yeah, I know. That's what I'm thinking about.
But you know, the unique texture and flavor of ciabatta comes from bread flour, white flour. And of course, white flour is high in gluten, and we hear a lot about gluten-free diets now, and of course white flour is off limits to people with celiac disease, that intolerance to gluten. But the good news is that gluten can be eliminated by kneading the dough, and then you actually literally wash out the starch. The gluten can be extracted. Starch actually disperses in cold water. It can be sedimented and dried, and washing the dough with a saline solution also removes the impurities in that dough. Of course, it's a more involved process, but bread lovers with celiac disease should take heart, because food science is working very diligently to put dough-based products back on the menu for them.
You know, my first bread was cornbread.
Cornbread?
Yeah, no, absolutely.
Well, that makes sense.
No, first bread was cornbread, and if you want to talk about a food that epitomizes a culture, cornbread is without a doubt the bread of the South. Thousands of years before European explorers arrived here in the New World, the Native Americans were mixing water and ground raw corn grains to create a bread that didn't exist anywhere else in the world. During the Civil War, wheat flour was often unavailable, and cornmeal was a good substitute. It was the base for high-rising, fluffy loaves, fried unleavened corn pones, as they call it, the Johnny Cakes that were so famous, named after me in the Civil War. Anyway, it's been on Southern tables ever since, and I'll tell you what, hush puppies. I was going to say,
what about cornbread hush puppies? You cannot eat fried fish if you don't have a little hush puppy.
Y'all, I'm going to tell you, today we're talking bread, and you can tell there's a lot of foolishness in the kitchen right now, but we're having fun at it, because bread is one of our favorite subjects, and all you have to do is look at us to tell.
You are a little hush puppy right now,
because
we
got to
go to break.
Y'all will be back in a minute. I'm going to hush my mouth.
Baby, ask me why. If you ain't got no bread, consider yourself lost. Cause the bed is what it costs. The bed.
What you want, baby?
Greetings. I'm Jake Hebert.
And I'm Adam Chouard. Join us every Friday at midnight for the Sound Club radio program.
Your home for left field pop gems from today to yesteryear.
Here on 88.7 FM KRVS.
Hi, I'm Pete Bergeron. If your day starts early, like mine does, let's spend it together with Cajun music from 5 to 7 a.m. here at Public Radio for Acadiana, KRVS, 88.7 FM, Lafayette, Lake Charles.
Everybody, welcome back to Stirring It Up, the best tasting food and culture show on radio. Today we're talking about one of my favorite subjects, all types of dough, and that includes money. Michelle. There's so many great bread stories about the area we live in, but also breads of the world, going all the way back, as you said, a Neolithic man, Michelle. So I'd like to hear more about that later. But now we have a great guest, somebody I have a tremendous respect for, and somebody who works real hard to teach young culinarians the way of bread. Mm-hmm. And why don't you introduce him?
He's molding young minds.
That's exactly right. He's kneading
young minds. He's kneading young minds. That's right. Today we have with us Chef John Kozar, Associate Professor at the Chef John Foles Culinary Institute at Nicholls State University there in Thibodaux. Chef Kozar is actually a native of one of your favorite places on the planet, La Trobe, Pennsylvania. He joined the Culinary Institute in 2002. He graduated from college with a BS in Applied Mathematics, and he originally pursued a career as a computer programmer. We'll have to ask him kind of what changed his vision from mathematics to culinary, but he decided to attend the Pennsylvania Culinary Institute. He graduated in 1992 and then began work as assistant pastry chef at the Duquesne Club. Then he came south, Beau Rivage, where he ran the casino's round-the-clock pastry kitchen. Now at the Culinary Institute, he teaches the baking classes. Of course, he teaches other classes, too, food, beverage, labor cost control, purchasing, sanitation. He was appointed department head of the Institute in 2011, and we are just delighted to have Chef John Kozar on the radio show for the first time. Welcome to Stirring It Up.
Well, thank you. It's my pleasure.
And John, as Michelle was reading your bio, first of all, two things: that you worked at the Duquesne Club. I knew that, and you worked there along with Keith Koganauer, right?
Yes, sir, of course. And David Harris, of course.
And David Harris. Was David, did you know David at the time?
He was hired about a few weeks after I was, back in 93. Yeah, I got to work with him for about 3 years up there, and he was actually the person I contacted when I was leaving Beau Rivage to look for another job, and got me in contact with the Institute.
Yeah, David, as most people know, is our pastry chef here at Chef John Foles & Company. And another thing I want to mention, you come from a little town, a beautiful little town of La Trobe, Pennsylvania, which is right outside of Pittsburgh, not that far away. And I have to tell you a quick story. My first trip ever out of Louisiana, I was going to Johnstown, I think it is, Pennsylvania. I'm not sure.
Right.
And I was going to a hotel conference for a company that ran a hotel that I went to work for as a young kid in food and beverage. And these folks were just great restaurateurs and hoteliers. And as I got to Johnstown, we had a couple of days vacation, so we rented a car and drove around and ended up in La Trobe. Now, you know the famous country club there, right?
Yes, I do.
Okay. Well, being an inquisitive young mind, I drove on to the...
You went to the country club.
Yeah, I drove up to the country club.
You were a member?
No, I wasn't a member. In fact, I don't even remember how I found the place, let alone being a member. But there's a tower there, and I wanted to see inside the building. It seemed that it was kind of closed down. So I walked up onto this tower to look inside the window, and all of a sudden, two police cars came by.
Oh, dear.
And me and my friend, another chef, was standing outside there, and the cops came and said, come on, get down. What are you doing? What are you trying to break in? I said, no, I'm from Louisiana, and this is a beautiful place. I've never seen anything like I've never seen. I was so interested in looking inside this place. I said, this is a private club. You need to move on out of here. You got to get on out of La Trobe. And then, John, so I didn't get arrested, but I got reprimanded for being on private property without asking, as most Louisianians always do. Why we get arrested for being in the wrong place. Anyway, 10, 15 years later, as president of the American Culinary Federation, I was invited to do a speech at the La Trobe Country Club.
Really?
So I walk into La Trobe Country Club, and I get to the microphone with all the chefs of Pennsylvania, and in the grand ballroom of the club, I walk up to the microphone, and I said, this is my second visit here. My first visit, I was arrested for class. And the chefs all just fell out as I told them the story about climbing the tower. And it was still there. It was outside the club. Anyway, it's great to know that two great places, the Duquesne Club and La Trobe, that you were at both of those. So how's everything at Nicholls State University?
Things are going great down here. I've got a couple of online classes going on the summer, but we've got the Bistro Restaurant class running. In fact, they're doing their Russian service in about 30 minutes today.
Oh, wow.
Oh, my God. And I know you got a full dining room for that, huh?
Yeah, they sure do. And that'll be a 7-course meal and beautiful service. I don't know if you've had a chance to see that, but it's a wonderful, wonderful meal.
Is there one of those a year, or is there a couple of those?
There are several. Over the summer, we do two. The students are rotating between the dining room management and the kitchen, and so each set does a Russian service.
Is there any open seats on one of them? I might have to go sit down.
We still have seats for the July, and then we're going to run four over the fall semester because they are very popular.
You know, we should expand on that conversation a little bit because we know what bistro is, but maybe some of our listeners don't. We should expose them to that because it's so fabulous, the student-run restaurant.
Yeah, why don't you tell us a little bit about that while our listeners are, because the Chef John Falls Culinary Institute at Nichols State is now, I guess, running into about its, 15th year or 16th year or so. Mm-hmm. And, of course, we have a whole new building we want to talk about in a minute. But, yeah, tell us a little bit about the students coming through the institute and how they eventually get to where we're talking about now, the bistro, et cetera. Tell us a little bit about that walk through culinary.
Alrighty, the freshman, sophomore years culinary students come in and they take all of the basic laboratory classes. They'll learn how to make stock soups and sauces. They'll learn how to do their knife techniques, all the basic cooking techniques. They'll take a baking class with me and garde-manger. And then they'll go at the junior level into the bistro class, which is a student-run restaurant. And they will create their own menus and go ahead and go through the whole purchasing process, costing out the recipes, and then executing that menu to a live audience. We hold it at the Carmel Inn. We're leasing their kitchen and dining room space until the new building is up. And they do probably between 90 and 120 guests for a seating.
I mean, that's pretty substantial when you think of a student-run restaurant, 100 guests, and they have to prepare, they have to write menus, buy everything.
That's a fabulous exercise in reality, which I think a lot of times, you know, college students miss, but I have to commend the university for that. That is fantastic.
And again, when you talk about the Russian service, what date is it that you do have some open spots?
Okay, let me get the calendar up here. It's the last Friday in July, which should be the 26th.
All right, well, hey, y'all, the last Friday in July, and all you have to do is call Nichols State University, and I'm sure they'll be able to fit you right on in. I just asked for the Chef John Falls Culinary Institute that you want to get into that the bistro dinner. They'll tell you how to get in. And we'll put that on our website.
I'm surprised there are any places left because those are hot tickets.
Yeah, the last Friday in July. Good. We'll make a note of that. Slama, you make sure you make a note of that for us over there. He's saying yes. Okay, good.
Got it.
Now, Michelle was asking about the move from technology, and it certainly wasn't a move from technology because culinary is so technologically based today. But you moved from computer science into culinary. What was that move all about? What made that happen?
Well, I was becoming very frustrated with sitting at a desk and pushing papers and writing computer programs, and I thought, I can't live like this anymore. I want to be able to do something that I can see immediate results with. And all my life, I had been fascinated with cooking, and finally one day I said, I am going to become a baker, and that was pretty much it. I signed up for culinary school the next week, and never really looked back.
Well, why baking? And I think it is a very good fit because where there's a lot of artistry and culinary, baking is more of a science. So I can see where a mathematical brain and a computer brain would do very well in bread. But why did you choose baking?
It's interesting that you say that because bread was what attracted me to school. I always loved the smell of fresh bread, you know, as it's rising, the alcohol's forming in it. And then baking, you get all those wonderful aromas with the sugars caramelizing. And, you know, I had always thought, yes, I want to be a baker. But at that time, you know, there was a school in Pittsburgh and there was no pastry program. So I went through the whole culinary program, which was great because then I got the whole background. But by the time I got to the baking section of the school, I was like, yeah, this is definitely what I want to do. You know, as a pastry chef or as a baker, you do need to do a lot of planning. It's not the same as performing live on that hotline and the pressure that is associated there. You have a lot more time to plan and test things out. We tend to be more, I say, a little bit more organized than the average hot food chef.
Well, and you have to be. I mean, it's a true statement. I mean, you absolutely have to. I watch my pastry chefs at Revolution, and I don't know if you've had a chance to meet any of the guys at our restaurant in New Orleans, but, you know, I watch that pastry team over there, which is made up of probably 10 or so pastry chefs.
Wow.
Yes, we have a couple of students from Nichols in the kitchen now over there, working in Godmoger in a couple of areas. They're doing really, really well. But I love to go just kind of hang out in that area, not only to taste the products of their work, but also at the same time just to see that create, because they're thinking, they're planning, they're drawing out on paper. Whereas the hotline, as you mentioned, across the way, you can watch just a fire and brimstone going on. You know, they're moving fast, they're wiping their faces, they're throwing skillets onto the fire, the smoke and fire is coming out when the meat hits the skillet. There's a lot of that action, whereas in the pastry department, there's a lot of thinkers going on. It's like going from the library to the racetrack. Now let's jump to the Duquesne Club. My God, one of the most famous, one of the oldest clubs in the United States. I mean, a club that has some of the greatest names in American entrepreneurship involved in it. Did you start out your pastry life there?
Pretty much. I had done a brief externship for culinary school at a yacht club, of all things, in Pittsburgh. But that was just a couple of months, and then I was able to get right into the club. The club was a great opportunity to see first-class fine dining and do quite a lot of bit of exciting things.
And then from there to Beau Rivage?
Beau Rivage taught me a lot about quantity.
I was going to say, I would think that the Duquesne Club was probably not near the volume.
No. I mean, Beau Rivage, our buffet served 2,000 to 5,000 guests a day.
Whew.
So, yeah, that was quite a different experience. And then we had 11 food outlets that the bakery supplied. So it was a 24/7 shop. And again, I learned a lot just by how to manage that kind of volume and still put out high quality product.
With all your experience in bacon, it seems a simple thing to talk about ingredients, but there's a lot of chemistry involved in bacon, and particularly with bread. Can you tell us a little bit about that? Because I find bread's not the easiest thing to make, at least for me.
Yeah, the home recipes that you see for making bread don't go into detail about the scientific method behind it. Yeast breads commonly depend on gluten, and the gluten is found mostly in wheat flour. So if you are using something like a rye flour, it's not going to have the gluten quantity to give you the texture that people look for in yeast breads. So that's the first thing you have to look for. We use something called a high gluten flour so that we can control and get a higher gluten development. The other thing that affects that is how much liquid is in it. The gluten in the flour doesn't do anything until water is introduced to it. And how much time you leave it in contact with the water and how hard you knead it affect how chewy or how smooth a dough might become. Other things are the fat. If you put a fat in it, there's a reasoning that fat is called shortening because it shortens the gluten strands. So a higher fat product is going to have a less chewy texture because it doesn't have that gluten that has developed.
Like a biscuit versus a piece of French bread.
Right, and a biscuit, well, of course, there are some yeast biscuits, but typically a biscuit is a quick bread
right.
And doesn't use yeast.
Right.
You need gluten development to get the structure of the biscuit, but you really have to develop a good touch with your hand to tell when, if you over-knead it, it's going to become a hockey puck.
Right. Now, John, this gigantic movement in the country today, which excites so many young people wanting to get into bakery, these artisanal breads, these artisanal bakeries, all these terms you hear, how does that differ from a regular commercial operation? And is artisanal really a good or an accurate word to use today when we talk about bakeries?
Well, an artisanal bakery is going to do things in a slower fashion. They're using flours that have a little less protein content, similar to what they use in Europe, and they take longer fermentation times. They'll have starters, and there are all sorts of types of starters. You can make your own yeast dough starter, or you can use wild yeast available in nature to do a pre-ferment or a starter. And depending on the acidity level in the yeast growing naturally in your area, you'll get different flavors. That's, San Francisco is a great example of where you can get a good sourdough bread. That's how it's different. It's usually done by hand in smaller quantities in an artisanal bakery because it really means to work with your hand
The
dough.
Right, less machine, less cooks, and more time, right? Michelle and I were talking about the gluten-free foods out there and this huge rise, maybe because there's always been a need, but now there's a supply, so there's more talk about it, and there's more people doing it, about the gluten-free movement out there. Tell us a little bit about working with gluten-free products.
Well, that's an interesting subject. We have an alumnus who has a bakery in Metairie called the Peace Bake Baker, and her products are entirely gluten-free. All of her cookies and breads entirely gluten-free because she herself is gluten intolerant.
Yeah, I'm sorry, what was the name of it?
The Peace Baker, and it is on Veterans Boulevard in Metairie, and her name is Kelly Buffoni.
Right, I know Kelly.
I think on the Nichols website there's a write-up in the alumni section about her this month and her bakery and what a success it is. And last Friday, Chef Randy and I met with a Dr. Timothy Harlan from Tulane. They have a culinary medical center there. He himself turns out to be gluten intolerant. And so we had some interesting conversations about diet and things that he had to watch for, as well as a new exciting thing that they are doing is teaching their medical students how to cook so that they can better relate to their patients.
Wow, that's unbelievable. So y'all met with them on a program that you're wanting to develop or just for information finding?
Well, we met with them. They are looking for some externs, so students that might go help with teaching both the medical students, as well as they do community outreach, and they offer, like, diabetics a 6-module training course in how to cook for themselves.
Right, right. Chef, can you hang on for a minute? We're going to take a quick break, and we'll bring you back after the break. Would you do that for us?
Certainly.
Okay, good. Y'all, we'll be back in just a minute. Don't you dare go anywhere.
Give me a bread and butter, woman. A woman who wants a yacht, a mansion and wine that bubbles. If she doesn't get the things she wants, she will give a man plenty troubles.
Give me a bread and butter woman
who doesn't care how much you make.
What's happening musically in Dakar? Joburg, Kinshasa, Port Spain, Havana, Accra, Dar es Salaam, Cairo, Paris, New York. Well, tune in this week and every week to find out on Afropop Worldwide from PRI, Public Radio International.
Sunday night at 8 on KRVS.
Our music on the Thistle and Shamrock transcends boundaries, expands horizons, celebrates tradition, stimulates innovation. It's music to bring people together, so why don't you join us?
Coming up Sunday evening at 6, here on KRVS.
Comics avec Val. Bienvenue dans le monde francophone. C'est tous les jeudis à 9h sur KRVS, la radio Acadie.
Hi everyone, this is Pat Mitchell-Worley, host of Bill Street Caravan. Join me each week for live performances from blues clubs and festivals around the world. We'll also have feature host segments that give you the stories behind the music. That's Bill Street Caravan, Saturday nights at 11 p.m. here on KRVS, 88.7 FM, Lafayette, Lake Charles.
T'as des misères à réveiller le dimanche matin? Mais allume la radio avec moi, Louis Michaud, tous les dimanches matins, 7h jusqu'à 9h. On va charrer en français, écouter de la musique en français et boire une petite tasse de café. Join me, Louis Michaud, if you have trouble waking up in the Sunday mornings. Just turn your radio to KRVS from 7 to 9 and hear me with Le Réveil, The Awakening en français.
You're listening to KRVS 88.7 FM, Lafayette, Lake Charles, and on the web at krvs.org. Find us on Facebook at KRVS Public Media.
Bread and water. Bread and water. All day living on bread and
water. All right, everybody, welcome back to Stirring It Up, the best tasting food and culture show on radio. And we're very excited today to be talking to a guy who I get a chance to work with quite a lot, department head at the Chef John Foles Culinary Institute, the guy who knows all about bread and baking. And right before we went to the break, we were talking about one of our students who now has a very successful gluten-free bakery in New Orleans. And, of course, gluten-free is now one of the huge buzzwords that we're all talking about. And nowadays, John, let's jump into the program at Nicholls State just a little bit. Tell us about the pastry curriculum there and how does it differ from, say, what's available at maybe other schools in the area, if there's a difference.
Okay, well, as I talked about earlier, the first 2 years students spend in the laboratories learning what they're going to learn at pretty much any culinary institute. They're going to learn the basics of how to cook, involving the classic French technique. But at Nicholls, we have an opportunity in the last 2 years, a student might pursue a pastry concentration. And our students are going to take classes like cake decorating and candy making. This fall, we have Chef Tariq Hanna coming in from New Orleans to teach that class. So I know our students are very excited about that.
Oh, absolutely.
Yes.
What a great company he has in New Orleans, Sucre.
Yes, indeed. And I'm very excited to have him here as well. We teach also, in following the mission of the school, we teach baking and pastries of the South, where we focus on all sorts of things, all the different types of biscuits and breads, pies, cakes, and cookies that are made in the South, and then how you might serve them in today's restaurant.
Now, you know, before we get off of that, that's very, very interesting because, and I'll tell you a story. Our executive pastry chef at Revolution, Erin Swanson, who worked with Gail Gann for so many years, and she is absolutely one of the top pastry chefs in the country, no doubt about it. Her concentration in pastry is incredible to her. Her creations are magnificent. But I was shocked when I walked into the kitchen one day and I said, you know, man, we just want a good pie. You know, and she said, well, I don't do pies. I said, what? She said, oh, no, chef. I do tarts and I do, you know, and she went into this, but she says, you know, like southern pies, the way y'all do them, like your lemon meringues and your apple pies and your peach pies. And she said, I'm not really good at that, but I can have one of our people do it. And I said, whoa, now what? Now let me think about that for a while. And I really did. I had to think about it because, you know, I just say, well, if you're a baker, you bake everything. But you just said something that made me think about that when you said, and how these pies are baked and served in southern traditions, because that's what she explained to me. She said, you know, chef, pies are so southern. She says, and I grew up in Chicago in the north, and we did all these beautiful pastries, but I never concentrated on these pies that y'all are so famous for. I said, well, baby, let me tell you what, we need to do that. And now she's doing great pies. But yeah, why is that? Why is pies really that concentrated to the South?
Well, certainly pecan pie is, but boy, up north, when I grew up, we had pie a lot. My grandmother made apple pie. She had an apple tree in her backyard. And
so you think it might just be cultural amongst families more so than it is region?
I think so, yeah.
Okay, well, good. Well, that's good.
But the thing I like about the South is they're not afraid to put lard in their pie dough.
I guess not. I mean, it's a religion, huh?
It is. Oh, makes a delicious and wonderfully flaky crust. So, I'm happy to teach that to the students.
Is that something you didn't do before you got South?
Well, my grandmother used to bake with it, but, my parents' generation were, no.
Now, John, getting back to the comments you were making, you say you're teaching a course on Southern pies. I didn't want to get you off track there, so tell us a little bit more about that.
Okay, let me see. In that class, when I first started here, a woman named Brenda Joy Floyd had just graduated from the program, and she had researched baking and pastry recipes of the South. You know, unfortunately, she just passed away this spring, but...
The
research
that
she did was published this spring, and I was able to write a foreword to that book saying how valuable her research was to me getting started. It was a little bit intimidating to come from Pennsylvania, and then all of a sudden you've got to teach a class on baking and pastries of the South.
Right, sure.
At that point, I don't really think I knew what a king cake was. We had talked about them in Mississippi, but I don't think I ever even saw one over there. And then I discovered king cake is a yeast bread, and it's like, it's not a cake. It's a bread. And, over the last 10 years, I've been able to do a lot of research. And, just like gumbo, our king cakes over in western Louisiana are more like this. And maybe in New Orleans, they use a little bit more egg product in it, make it a little bit richer dough.
Right.
It's been a fascinating learning experience for me.
Well, I think I just hearing what you were saying about breads of the South versus, I think so, because one of my executives, Sue, pastry chef, is also from the North, and she's one of the best pie makers. She was on the show, in fact, a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah.
And she was just fabulous in her pie. She does a pie that drives me crazy, and all I got to do is say pie, and she'll whip out about 10 of them. And she's great, so you want to definitely come and taste her pie. She's a wonderful, wonderful pastry chef. Our Sue there, who's really fabulous. Anyway, John, just before we let you go, why should students look at Nicholls State University? What makes us different?
We offer a university education, which is great. That's how I came into the business. I already had a bachelor degree, and then I learned how to cook. But, that took 5 years to do. Here, this is a 4-year bachelor degree program, which is unique in the state. And the students are learning how to cook in the traditional method, as well as getting a great general education. So they're going to take their math and science and English classes here, so that they can be the leaders in the kitchen when they go out.
And that is quite different from your associate's degree, which focuses mainly on the culinary skills.
In addition to the pastry concentration, we have a service concentration for those who want to manage front of the house. We've got a great professor, Don Kasten, who is wonderfully experienced in front of the house, and he's doing a great job with those students. I am working this summer to get a business concentration whereby our students can earn a business minor in the 120 hours that they will use to get their culinary degree.
Wow.
That's awesome.
And it's hoped that we can offer those last 2 years entirely online so we can attract students from other culinary institutes that might have those associate's degree and have them earn a bachelor degree through Nicholls State.
And they can do it all online.
Right.
That's fantastic. Now, jumping quickly into the new facility, the new building that we've been waiting for so long. Tell us a little bit about the excitement on campus about that building, because we just broke ground, and I think it's slated to be completed hopefully at the end of next year if things go well. But tell us a little bit about that building and what does it bring to the Institute?
It's going to bring a lot of space to us. Right now, of course, as you know, we're in an old biology building, and it really wasn't designed to be a kitchen teaching facility. So we will have 4 state-of-the-art equipped with brand new equipment kitchens, the teaching kitchen. We'll have the skills kitchen. We'll have a separate kitchen for meat fabrication and garde-manger. They'll have their own cold room in there with a band saw so they can work at the proper temperatures for handling all of the meat. We'll have a soups and stocks kitchen, and we will have a dedicated pastry kitchen. We'll also have a demonstration kitchen our own lecture room, and then, of course, the restaurant and its kitchen are going to be located in that building as well.
So it's going to concentrate all of our activities plus some of our to the public activities in our own facility right next to the main campus of Nicholls State. Students can take all of their courses and then walk right onto the right next door on into the culinary center where we're sitting on this beautiful acreage right on by Lafourche at Thibodaux, Louisiana. And it's been the efforts of state government. It's been the efforts certainly of our governor, of our representatives and senators in the legislature, Senator Chaubert, who's done an unbelievable job, Joe Harrison, these guys who have really moved the process forward along with our other legislators from the area. And we want to thank them so much for the effort. This is over a $12 million project that's coming to fruition after many years, and we could not be more excited about it. And, John, I want to thank you for the great work that you do. It's great to work with y'all because I have an opportunity to teach there as well in the spring and the fall. And it's always good to know that we can rub shoulders with our professors there and in the activities that we're involved in. So thanks so much for all that you do and, of course, all the inspiration you bring to our students and naturally for the work that you do to put the Chef John Falls Culinary Institute on the map nationally. We appreciate it so much.
Well, I'm glad to say I love my job.
And we love you. So thank you, John, and we'll see you later. Go bake some bread or something.
All right, sir.
Thank you, John. All right, y'all. John Kozar, what a great guy.
He is.
He's really
very
passionate.
Dedicated, passionate.
Always, he's a guy that you can always know when you see him. He's always thinking food. He's really a great guy. Shlomo, anything you want to mention on our Starting It Up Facebook page?
I'd just like to let people know out there that it exists. If you want to talk about the show, that is the place to do it, on Facebook.
That's share a recipe swap.
Yeah, we do all kinds of, we post pictures if you want to check out what the theme is looking like this week. You know, we got some pictures coming up, and also, we're always looking for ideas from our stovehounds, so, you know, by all means, come on by.
Perfect. Michelle, books for the library. What's a couple of good books?
I love this book, The History of Bread by Bernard Dupain. It is full of fantastic history, beautiful artwork, glossy color photos that make you want to eat the page, evolution of bread making, ancient times to the present. I just love that this author tells the story of how the many different bread grains are cultivated, gathered, processed, often painstakingly by hand to make our daily bread. You're taken back in time around the world to different cultures. And bread is not just sustenance, it's also symbolism. We see that a lot at Easter on the St. Joseph's altar. Just fascinating book. Definitely think that this is a beautiful book that you want to peruse. It's a coffee table book. It's a kitchen table book. I just love it.
No, it is. It's beautiful. I like that bicycle and bread right there. You see that? Plus all the historical data. It's really great.
Look, one of our favorite pictures.
Do you know we stood, y'all, she's looking at the mosaic of the loaves and fishes in the church of the multiplication, I think they call it.
Multiplication
of loaves and fishes in Israel. We stood there just a couple of months ago in front of that mosaic that we had chosen for our own book on Hooks, Lies, and Alibis, The History of Fishing, and to think that we stood in front of that mosaic. And it's in the book.
I think our photo's better than that one.
Well, it could be. Actually, it could be.
I have a second book.
Okay, go ahead.
It's Bread Baking by Lou Seabare Pappas. The first part of the book is about how to make and work the dough, which is, you know, as we were just hearing from Chef Kozar, kind of a critical step there. Then the chapters take you from basic breads to international breads to dessert breads. There's even a recipe for hamburger buns, which I would never even think about making, you know. But if you're serious about bread baking, you'll definitely enjoy this book. So that's Bread Baking by Lou Seabare Pappas and The History of Bread, Bernard Dupain.
Well, I tell you what, both of those are fabulous books. We have them in our library. And again, y'all, we put all of this information on our website, jfalls.com. Just go up to Starting It Up, the radio show, and you can find everything we talk about, all of these resources. And, hey, just add a book or two a week to your library, and I tell you what, before long, you will have one of the best culinary libraries in the world, and you can just follow the shows with the books. Michelle, a couple of options today on on recipes, since we're talking bread, I can do a basic quick bread for you, or I can do a cream biscuit. One's a bread, one's a biscuit. Basic quick bread, if you want one.
Yeah, let's do that.
This is an hour and 15 minutes, and you have a loaf of bread. And it's a good loaf of bread, and it doesn't take a whole day to make. And there's a lot of quick recipes for bread, but I like this one right here. It's really good. And I do have a couple of recipes in our cookbooks as well. Any of the John Falls cookbooks will have some of the quick breads in it. But this one right here is very simple. You're going to preheat your oven to 350. You're going to grease and flour 1 8.5 by 4.5 loaf pan. You can spray with a little nonstick spray. Yeah, you got one of those pans, right, Michelle?
No, I'm putting it on my grocery list.
8.5 by 4.5. Come on, if you don't have that bread, I mean, everybody has that. You make a little cornbread in it or something. 8.5 by 4.5 loaf pan.
You don't make cornbread in a loaf pan.
Well, sometimes I do. Okay, in a large bowl, y'all, you're going to combine 2 cups of all-purpose flour, 1/2 teaspoon of baking powder, 1/2 teaspoon of baking soda, and 1/2 teaspoon of salt. And you can just kind of mix that together in a large bowl, and all of your dry ingredients there. You can sift it if you want to, but just kind of mash it with a spoon and mix it around. In the bowl of an electric mixer on a high speed, you're going to beat or whip, as we say, 1/2 cup of butter softened. You're going to whip that with 3/4 cup of sugar. Now, you're thinking to yourself, oh, my God, this is a very sweet bread. Well, you can lower the sugar if you want, but this makes a really nice bread. 3/4 cup of sugar. You're going to whip that until light and fluffy, and the butter and the sugar is really whipped high. Then you're going to add into that 2 eggs, one at a time. Just drop them in and blend them in. And once that's in, 1 cup of buttermilk. So now you got that buttermilk action with the acid that's going to really set that baking powder and baking soda, get it really actioned up, so to speak. Now you're going to spoon this mixture into the prepared loaf pans. You're going to bake it in that 350 preheated oven, 55 to maybe 60 minutes, an hour or so. And you want to make sure that when you put that toothpick down into the center, it comes out nice and clean. Once you take it out of the oven, you cool it on a rack. You want to put it like on a rack or you know, let some air get under it for about 10 minutes or so, just until you can turn it over and unmold it. Then you're going to let it cool 1 hour before slicing. Y'all, make a little bread. Some you can spend and some you can eat. Hey, we encourage you to do it.